the agenda today includes, present today are Senator Miller, Senator Lehman, and myself, Lyda Green. First item today is SB 98.
I'll be real subtle about where I am on this.
Is that the tragedy of American compassion?
I'm going to be real subtle, Portia.
Portia Babcock, our PDA, will be walking us through the explanation of this bill.
Madam Chairman, I believe we need to adopt the committee here. I would move the water back 319 or 31695 version and move the original bill. Okay.
Without objection? Use CS for Senate Bill 98 as our work draft. We're working on that now. Portia.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Portia Babcock, Committee Aide to the Senate HES Committee. If it's the will of the committee, I would like to just walk through the bill section by section quickly, and of course, if there are questions, I will attempt to answer them. Working off of the draft CS 316 version, Section 1 just gives a short title to the bill. Section 2 requires that in order to qualify for public assistance, that a needy person needs to be a United States citizen. Section 3 provides that for permanent ineligibility for convicted of basically welfare fraud, it's unsworn falsification in the state, and other statutes that are similar to that in other states will also apply. And that will be permanent ineligibility if you're convicted. Section 4 of the bill establishes a 30-day residency requirement. It's 30 days because that's what the attorneys believe is constitutionally acceptable, or possibly is constitutionally acceptable. Anything longer than that, they felt that we would run into problems with this kind of a program. Other states are doing this, attempting to do this right now with a 30-day residency requirement, and they're fairly new. I know that with longer residency requirements, some of them have been challenged and thrown out in other states. Section 5 reduces AFDC payment levels to allowable federal minimums. They were adjusted in the original bill. The numbers are a little different, and we worked it out with Health and Social Services. These are the allowable minimums that we, according to the department, are allowed to go down to and still be in compliance with federal law.
Madam Chairman, Ms. Babcock, that is under existing programs,
correct,
assuming no change, which, of course, they are probably going to be changed, but we don't know.
That is correct. Going to end up.
This is okay.
Then we may need to amend this to say are the federal allowable minimum, if that's our intent. It's something we might want to think about.
I see. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Section 6. This section is new from the original version, which requires the department to refer AFDC applicants to the jobs program to help them develop a plan for self-sufficiency when they immediately upon coming in and applying for AFDC, they don't need to wait to be approved. They send them right to the jobs program and develop a self-sufficiency plan and get them moving into programs for either training, job search, immediately without any kind of a delay. And this can be done administratively, actually, but this by putting it in statute, it requires them, as the department shall, inform the applicant about the Job Opportunity Basic Skills Program. The department shall also assist the applicant and each adult member of the applicant's household with the development of a plan, outlines the steps that may be necessary for the person to take in order to become self-sufficient. Section 7 Section 7N8 require minor parents to live with, minor parents to live with their parents, relatives, or other adult supervised arrangements in order to qualify for AFDC. Now, AFDC payments, if they qualify and they are living at home with their parents or an adult relative, the payments will be made to the parent of the minor parent or the adult supervisor in an arranged home. One of the minor can only qualify to live in an environment other than a parent, guardian, or adult relative if they meet certain criteria. And that is listed on page 3 of the bill in section 8. The department shall require as a condition of eligibility for assistance that a minor parent must reside in that has one and two, the minor's parent, legal guardian, adult relative's own home. And they can, the second option, which is the foster parent home or adult supervised supportive living arrangement, only if the minor, and then it spells out what those requirements are they must meet they can't choose. I can either live at home or go live in a foster home. They need to have one of these criteria need to apply. So the first option is that they live at home or with relatives, with parents. There are exceptions to that. If it's not available, the parent won't let them live there. It may be harmful or dangerous for the minor to stay in that environment or to the minor's child. And those exceptions are all spelled out in the bill on page 4, lines 3 through 27. Section 9 of the bill allows the department to set out criteria for determining whether a person is in noncompliance with required programs, and that they will be allowed under federal law apply sanctions for noncompliance or non-participation in programs that the department has required them to participate in. And this is spelled out on page 5, line 4 through 19. It would reduce AFDC benefits by 20% for noncompliance or non-participation in these specified programs. Or 2, which is on line 10, dependent child of school age fails without good cause to meet standards of adequate levels of school attendance. For work experience training programs, a person who's required to attend school, job training, counseling, substance abuse treatment programs, or refuses to attend school, job training, counseling, or substance abuse programs, quits a job voluntarily. These are all required programs that if they do quit voluntarily or refuse to participate, their benefits will be reduced by 20%. Section 10 of the bill reduces adult public assistance levels by 1.7%. From the October 1, 1993 level, which I believe is the level right now. And so it would be a 1.7% reduction. Section 11 and 12 of the bill apply to SSI and interim assistance for SSI. And what this would change is currently the state pays interim assistance while a person is waiting during the appeal process. If they are denied initially and found to be ineligible, the state continues to pay while the appeal process is going on. And this would change that so that if the person who's applying is found ineligible at the first initial determination, then the payments stop then, or they never start, and only upon eligibility in the appeal process, then the person, if they are eligible, would receive back payments to the point of when they would have in the initial determination. But this was introduced last year in Senate Bill 101, and what was found, I think it was, going off the top of my head, I'll try to get these exact numbers, I think it was 83% of the denials were upheld, and they were denied for any interim or any assistance and didn't qualify for SSI, and the state could not recoup those costs, and it could have been going on for a year or two, and the state was having a very difficult time any of those costs. And in Section 13, that the person applying for assistance under the section shall, as a condition of eligibility for assistance, agree to repay the assistance to the state upon a final determination, so that if they are eligible at the first determination, then found ineligible, they would be required to repay during that status, during that time. Section 14 is, it repeals a section, a statute that that currently prohibits the department from requiring a minor parent to live with an adult or their parent in order to be eligible to receive AFTC. So that repeals that statute, and then we reenact to the department to require the minor parent to live with their parents or legal guardian or adult relative or in other situations or other. Section 15. Section 15 directs the department to apply for waivers by December 31st, 1997, to implement program changes for statewide implementation that haven't already become effective due to changes in federal law. Because the likelihood of federal law changing is quite high, the reasoning behind this was to give a 2-year period for those changes in federal law to affect whatever the state is doing, and then at that time, after two years, if the program still can't be implemented because of federal law, then to apply for waivers to implement that program. Section 16 is a 5-year time limit on AFDC benefits. So for not more than a total of 60 months, can qualify unless the person is permanently, totally, or physically or mentally disabled, then the time limit does not apply. And the time limit does not apply to APA, adult public assistance, at all. It's not addressed in the bill. Section 17 imposes a penalty for failure to keep an AFDC child of school age in school regularly and for failure for a teenage parent on AFDC to attend school. The department shall pay as an incentive to graduate from school and to continue on with education a $200 bonus upon graduation from secondary school or an equivalent level of technical or vocational training. And one thing I noticed in here is that GED is not mentioned in here specifically, and I'm not sure whether upon graduation whether that would qualify. It was the intent to have that qualify as well. And I'll have to talk with the attorney to make sure that if we need to spell that out in the bill to make it very clear. It also has that it can only be granted once per person. Section 18, a job retention requirement, which impose this section would require the department to sanction a recipient by 20% reduction in benefits who quits a job that was held at the time the person applied for AFDC voluntarily quits the job without immediately starting a new job that pays at least the same amount in earnings. Section 19 puts into statute a section that requires parentage establishment. At the time someone applies for AFDC, they must include on the application the name of each dependent child's mother and father. There are some stated exceptions here on page 7, lines 28 through 10 on page 8. The child was conceived as a result of rape or incest. The department determines that efforts to establish paternity would result in physical danger to the relative claiming the assistance, or the relative claiming assistance on behalf of the child alleges that any, well, not more than 3 named individuals may be the biological father of the child, and provides the address of each named individuals. I won't read through it, but.
Portia, have you checked the department to determine if just having the name of the parent is sufficient for them to track the responsibility? I assume that's why it's there, so we can track responsibility. We may have somebody coming into the state, been here for 31 days, applies for assistance, and there's a name given. Well, that name doesn't specify what state, doesn't have a Social Security number associated with it, or or something like that. Have you and your in your work on this got any feedback from the department on that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Lehman, the one question that did come up from the Child Support Enforcement Division was, are they required to legally establish paternity prior to approving the individual for benefits? And I was told that that can take up to 1.5 or 2 years, or it can take a long period of time. And don't think that was the intent, but the intent was to get this moving, at least in that direction, that the names are provided and the name and address, location, last known location, to facilitate establishing the parentage. Now, I don't know whether that may need to be clarified in the bill, that this doesn't mean that they must be established, that the legal paternity must be established prior to moving forward at all with any kind of assistance, but that they need to name on the application both parents in order to get the process moving. And it is the intention to have more than just a name, either the last, as much information, either an address or the last state or location of where you might think the person is, at least as much information as can be provided. And that may need to be spelled out more clearly.
Why don't you check on that? And maybe if we hear other testimony today, others might want to address that.
Okay, also for the record, let's show that Senator Salo arrived about 10 or 15 minutes ago. Any questions?
Section 20 requires the signing of a personal responsibility agreement that is described in B of this Section 20. This is very similar to many that other states currently have. Indiana, I think Michigan is called the social contract. Many other states, Virginia. We looked at what Indiana had adopted in their personal, and this is somewhat taken out of what Indiana has established.
Yes, interesting. Portia, in those other states, did they make it part of the statute? I mean, was it in law? It seems to me like that statement, you know, might better be in regs so that it could be more dynamic. I mean, if there could be changes made to it based on information that caseworkers thought they needed or didn't need.
Madam Chairman, Senator Salo, that's true, and that I don't know. I can't remember whether it was in statute or whether it was something that the department issued the actual language for the statement. I'll have to check into that. And that you may want to just give broad guidelines, because even now the new bill that just passed out of committee in Congress eliminates the jobs program. So it may be that different references, they may be state programs that are implemented now that are similar to the jobs program that are created because of a block grant that's given from the federal government, maybe have a different name. So that certainly is something that
need to be less specific then. Mm-hmm.
That I'll check into and make sure that I'm not sure how the department feels, but they would probably prefer to have a little more leniency we could spell out.
Well, one of the things we could do, you know, if the department isn't real excited about this, then we may want to offer some substantial guidelines so we can encourage them to do things like we'd like. You could say, shall read substantially as follows or something like that, and then we could argue with them over whether what they're producing is substantially as we direct. But since some of the people from the department are here, I'm sure they will want to implement what the legislature's intent is.
Section 21 prohibits no aid for additional children conceived while on welfare. This is similar from many. This is taken from several other states who have implemented similar laws in Massachusetts, Indiana, Virginia, and also is being considered at the congressional level. That, and we took the language similar to what has been is being used in other states, and that has been approved by the Clinton administration through waivers to implement. An individual who received assistance at any time during a 10-month period ending with the birth of the child. There is an exception for someone who applies for the very first time and is pregnant. The first child that would not apply for it would be subsequent children. Section 22, permanent welfare eligibility for welfare fraud. This is another section that applies to eligibility. The first one was for unsworn falsification. This is for welfare fraud upon conviction. Section 23 restricts AFDC and adult public assistance to U.S. citizens. And there are some stated exceptions here, except for emergency medical services or the person was admitted within 6 years immediately preceding the payment of assistance as a refugee. Is over 75 years of age, has resided in the United States for at least 5 years, and has been lawfully admitted to the United States for permanent residence. Section 24 requires the department to share information about illegal aliens with INS. Section 25 implements a program for transitional benefits. What we heard from a lot of people over the past several years in discussions is that the disincentives for people moving on or getting married where they were worried they were going to lose their benefits if they were on public assistance and wanted to get married or move into that situation, that there shouldn't be something at least that doesn't penalize. And so what this allows is the department to continue assistance under the section for a limited period of 6 months after marriage as a transitional program to move into that new situation without being immediately cut off. Section 26, alcohol and drug testing and treatment programs. Rather than require alcohol and treatment programs in statute for trying to set those parameters, this allows the department to determine if they believe that a person that is on public assistance is addicted to alcohol or drugs, then they will, and they can decide whether to put them into a program, require them to go into a treatment program. If the department does require them to go into a treatment program, the person shall agree to participate and maintain satisfactory participation in the addiction program if it's available. And, I mean, we haven't spelled out what the options are if it's not available, but in areas it's simply not available, so that's why that clause is in there. And two, to submit to tests for the presence of alcohol or drugs without advance notice while receiving the assistance. And those are for people who are required to be going to drug or alcohol treatment programs by the department. 20, Section 27 establishes a short-term emergency non-cash assistance project, which would provide food stamps, child care assistance, and Medicaid rather than putting that family on the full benefits of AFDC that the department can determine that the person is employed, but they're barely making it. They can't seem to get by. They're in an emergency situation. They're going to quit their job and go on AFDC. And the department determines that if they can give them a little assistance with food stamps or child or daycare assistance or Medicaid, one of the three or all, a combination of them, that they can keep their job, stay employed, and help them through a time period to slowly work back out of the situation and back into full employment or self-sufficient status. And that they are allowed to grant that for up to 6 consecutive months. And the department shall provide non-cash assistance in this section for at least 15% of the persons who apply for assistance. Section 28 is another section that speaks to applying for the waivers after the two-year period for federal laws has elapsed by December 31st of 1997 to apply for any remaining waivers that are still needed to implement the particular sections. Section 29, earned income disregard, waiver of 100-hour rule, and increasing the auto allowance to 5,000. I think those are, I won't go into any more detail on those unless the committee would like me to. Almost every state that's applied for a waiver has included this in their one of their waivers and has consistently been approved. In Section 30, this implements the workfare program in specified project areas as would be necessary for a waiver.
Thank you. I have a question here. What does in the project area mean?
Okay, in the project area, which is established, it would be what it is for municipalities or boroughs that used to be right in the same section with the workfare.
Page 16, very bottom.
Okay. So one municipality has the highest number of households, which would be Anchorage. Municipality contiguous to the municipality determined under one of this section, so that would be either Kenai, Sildan, or Mat-Su. And an area consisting of a home rule city that is contained within the boundaries of a second-class borough, population of at least 15,000 persons, and the second-class borough that contains the city described in A of this section. So the largest municipality, that's doubling over a few, that would be the same, which is Anchorage. The largest municipality is measured by square miles. I'm not sure if which area that would be, and that would have to be determined. The department would probably know better about.
You have an answer?
It's a North Slope borough.
I think
the subsection 3
would
probably be
Burmese. Right. I know, Madam Chairman, I know that you weren't here last year, but when we were trying to establish these project areas, a number of people in Fairbanks were complaining that they were left out of the list, and on the bill that I worked on last year, there was no good reason that Fairbanks shouldn't be on the list, and so we said yes. A number of people expressed interest in being in this project area. So that's why they were on last year, and I assume you took that list as a starting point for this project.
Within the workfare project area, a person who is 18 years of age or older shall participate for 21 hours a week in an uncompensated activity if assigned to the activity by the department. The department shall assess the availability of activities that satisfy the purposes of the subsection in each part of the project area, attempt to develop additional activities. The department shall penalize the family for failure for a person to comply with the subsection by disregarding the person as a member of the family for purposes of determining the amount of AFDC assistance given to the family. If they refuse to participate in the workfare activities, there are exceptions to this on the next page, page 13. The requirement to participate in uncompensated activity does not apply to a person who has paid employment of at least 15 hours a week, is in the jobs program, is in Indian or Native organization similar programs or activities, is exempt from participating in the jobs program, is the parent or relative of a sick child under 6 years of age living in the same household who personally provides care for the child. So that was one of the most common questions, was that for.
Can you repeat number 5?
Yeah. Is the parent, so the person, if they're over 18 years of age and they're in the project area, they cannot be required to participate in an uncompensated activity if they're the primary caregiver or care of a child who's under 6 years of age. is determined to be physically or mentally unable to perform any reasonable activity that may be assigned under this section, or is a parent who's providing care for a child with a developmental disability as defined by statute. And the department cannot require recipients to participate in the work fair without paying for necessary costs of child care and transportation expenses. Section 31 establishes a 2-year time limit, a 24-month time limit for a family in the project area who is has a member in their family assigned to an activity under the jobs program or the work fair program. So the 2-year time limit applies to a person who's participating in the jobs program or is in work fair. Basically, those who are the most job ready and the able-bodied who are ready to go to work right away, isn't the only caregiver for a very small child. Section 32 sets up a 2-tier payment system. A little of what's been going on throughout the rest of the United States is that many states have applied for a 2-tier payment system and have been denied waivers. And so Wisconsin developed a 2-tier payment system that met more of the requirements, and theirs was approved, and they have been operating under this 2-tier payment system now since July. And this is modeled after the Wisconsin approved waiver. What this would do is, requires the department to pay new residents in the project area at the AFDC rates that are in effect in their prior state of residence rather than at Alaska's rate for 6 months of residency, unless the family came, worked for a 3-month period, and then lost their job and then went on AFDC. That would not apply. So, and we're required to pay at the level of the previous state, even if it's higher, whether it's higher or lower. That was another one of the stipulations in the waiver. And 63, Section 33 is delineates the project areas. So when we refer to project areas, this is what we're talking about for the 2-tier system as well as the workfare program. 34 just requires that state agencies cooperate with the department in implementing the area. Section 36 Section 35 defines the terms that will be used in the project area. Section 36 gives an approximate 5-year duration of the provisions for which waivers are required. The 6/30/2003 date being about 6 years away from 97 allows a year for getting waivers and 5 years for the operate under the waivers for the demonstration project if it's needed under a waiver. Section 37 clarifies the applicability of the changes made to APA in sections 11 through 13 of the bill and make Section 3 constitutional by applying the new welfare fraud provisions to offenses committed on or after the effective date of the bill. Section 38 clarifies that provisions of this act supersede the provisions of the current AFDC statutes to the extent that this act takes effect. Section 39 explains the conditions under which Section 16 through 27 and 29 through 35 take effect. Authorization by federal law that take effect by the time this bill becomes law, and then authorization after it becomes effective, and authorization under the waiver of federal law. The Attorney General would make the determination of whether federal law or waiver authorization authorized a section to take effect. So monitoring what federal law changes when the effective date of that act is after, if this bill has passed and become effective, when that federal law becomes effective, we'd be allowed to implement the section that is no longer in violation of federal law. This was a little difficult for the drafter to try to put in, since law is changing so quickly, to make it effective if federal law passes, before this law passes, after it passes, and if we need a waiver, and giving that two-year time for things to settle down before we start applying for a bunch of waivers. Section 40 provides that if a section of the bill that applies only to a limited demonstration program becomes authorized under federal law, that section will be given statewide effect. So that if it's my understanding that if sections 16 through 27, 29 through 35, and section 39, 1A or 2 of this act, they apply on a statewide basis, not just in the project area, if all federal prohibitions are lifted to implementing that section. Section 41 gives effective dates to sections 16 through 27, 29 through 35. And this goes through the same thing immediately if federal law already authorizes it, and it goes through the steps of when they become effective. Section 42 gives an immediate effective date for provisions that don't need waivers or we don't need approval from the federal, or they don't violate any federal requirement or law.
Is there anyone from the department that wishes to speak today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Nordland. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Assistance. I'm not exactly sure how the committee wants to proceed on our comments on this bill. We, having just received this CS last night, would like some opportunity for the members of the experts in our department, as well as the other departments that are affected by this legislation, to sit down and come up with our positions on the various sections. We're planning to do that this afternoon. And I will say at the outset that it is fair to say that there are some sections of the bill that we would find acceptable, some that we would not find acceptable, and some that we would like to talk with you about and maybe work out and make more effective or a bit easier to implement. I would like to have my staff person talk, Kurt Lomas, perhaps talk with your staff for some language clarification and some, you know, intent clarification so that we can get started. We already are working on the fiscal note, but so we can get a little bit more direction in the development of the fiscal note. It does take some time, and we just need to sort of iron out some details there so we can do it more accurately. This is a huge bill. It has a dramatic effect on the management of the programs in this division, as well as some of the other divisions and departments. The governor's legislation that we had introduced, we prepared the fiscal note on that ahead of time. We spent 200 staff hours on the development of that fiscal note. This is bigger than that. It's more expansive in terms of its scope. And so you have been lenient with us, and we do appreciate that in understanding in terms of the effort that it takes the department to develop a response to this legislation. So with that said, I am a little reluctant to go into, you know, section by section our comments on the bill. I could say a few things, you know, about some of the sections if you want, but I'd prefer to wait if possible.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
I just wanted to be sure that if anyone in the room that had any testimony had the opportunity, certainly anyone from the departments or whatever, if you're ready today, that's fine. Otherwise, we'll just hold it. And because we have work session on Saturday, the 25th, from 12 to 4, that'll be out of this office for statewide teleconference. We'll certainly be taking more testimony then. And, we're still reading it, too, and learning. So the rush is not on. And we want to make it serve the purpose of what we're hearing needs to be served certainly with the consideration of what impact it has on you and what's going to work and what's going to practically be realistic to do. And so, but there, I think it also goes without saying that everything we hear says there have to be some changes. And I think this bill is looking very benevolent compared to what's happening at the federal level. So, and care, you know, in consideration of changes that they're coming through with and all. Senator Stano.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as you work on this bill and the ideas in it and the changes that occur, I would like to see the governor's bill on the table at the same time to juxtapose different approaches. And, I mean, that's, I've found in the former committee work that that's a very effective way to go if you've got two bills that deal with the same issues. And so I'd like to request that we also, somewhere during this process, hear that bill.
Right. Also, on next Wednesday and Friday, we'll be hearing. We'll have this bill back before the committee, SB 98, so we're certainly.
If I could make one comment, Madam Chair. One thing that is that I'm not sure you want to do with this bill, and it's a little bit problematic for us, is the concept that that if federal law changes, which is bound to change, that the demonstration projects that you have suggested in this bill would be applied on a statewide basis. All the projects that we've heard about around the country, what's going on in Wisconsin and various states, you have to keep in mind they're all demonstration projects. They're experiments. And in some cases we're finding that they work, in some cases we're finding that they don't work. To take what's intended to be an experiment and apply it all of a sudden statewide without really knowing whether it works or not, it may not even serve the ends that you're trying to achieve. I think that The sensible way to approach this is to wait until federal law passes, to regroup, to take a look. We're going to have a lot, chances are we're going to have a lot of flexibility to design programs the way that we want to have them designed, and to be tied into some projects that are intended to be, that were originally demonstration in nature, and apply them statewide, I think may not be such a good idea.
And I understand that, but by the same token, we have to look aggressively at work here. You know, and it can't, I don't see it as an option to have it otherwise. Maybe we phrase it in different words.
There might be some things in here that you would want to do regardless, but there's some things that are, the diversion project, for instance, we think it's a good idea. I know that you think it's a good idea, but we're not exactly sure how it's going to work. And to say that we're going to do that on a statewide basis forever, I don't think is a good idea.
Now, what is your explain to me again what it is you don't like about the workfare project?
The workfare project?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I wasn't necessarily commenting on the workfare project. I'm just saying that the blanket language that says that everything you're doing in this bill could apply statewide. I think we just need to look at that.
Sure. Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
I'm sure we'll see you back here.
Okay, we will.
Before Jim leaves.
Jim, Senator Lehman had a comment, a question.
Could you, at one of the next times we get back, be able to specify which of those things you think would not be appropriate to apply statewide because it may cause some challenges or whatever? If you could just be prepared to talk to us about that, great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Kurt, did you have anything today? Or would you rather wait? Okay, is there anyone else from a department that wishes to speak today? On SB 98. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak? Any further discussion at this point? Okay, Senate House is adjourned. Okay.